An upset in Alabama today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Doug Jones defeated Roy Moore in Alabama. What does that mean to British journalist Gary Young? He's traveled extensively in the American South, and here's how he sees the results in Alabama.
In a way, America looks to me like it is becoming more southern than the South is becoming more like the rest of America.
Plus, we remember San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee, who died this week, and his support for a controversial statue.
It's three girls, a Chinese girl, a Korean girl, and a Filipino girl, holding hand in hand, standing proudly in defiance of Japan.
It is a memorial to comfort women. Plus, we put extreme surveillance to the test in China. That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It is great to have you with us on this Wednesday. A lot to get to from all over the globe today, including two visions of our digital future, a glowing one from Estonia, a more sinister one from China. Those stories coming up later on the show. But we start right here in the U.S. with that big moment last night for Doug Jones, the Democrat who won the Senate seat once held by Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
I will tell you, tonight is a night for rejoicing, because as Dr. King liked to quote, the moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Jones giving a nod to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. last night. For Democrats, Alabama was a victory by a slim margin, but still a victory. For Republicans and Donald Trump, a loss in a race marred by allegations of sexual misconduct against the GOP candidate Roy Moore. But let's try to put all of this into a wider perspective, because you tune into The World to hear how the rest of the globe sees us. Gary Young is with the Guardian newspaper in Britain and was their longtime correspondent here in the States. He's now based in London and is the author of A Day in the Death of America. I asked Young what he thought motivated the high black turnout in Alabama.
These provocations that have come from Trump, the Take a Knee movement, or Charlottesville, where he's had the chance to either say nothing or to say something good or to say something neutral and has chosen to say something bad. There is a price to pay, and it wasn't obvious what that price would be while he was saying them, because they seemed to galvanize his base and his support. I think Trump is bringing out African-American voters in a way that Democrats couldn't, frankly. Mm. I mean, we're talking about Alabama. It's never been easy for black people to vote in Alabama. That's
I mean,
there's a reason why Rosa Parks came from there.
It's an interesting dynamic, what you were saying about Trump turning out the black vote. But it also reminds us that the divisions in the U.S. are as stark as ever. And the numbers coming in from the Alabama vote, I mean, it's just kind of crazy. 97% of black women went for Jones. 93% of black men went for Jones. And 74% of white men went for Moore. What does that tell you about how serious the divides are in America today?
The thing when it comes to race in America that one has to keep coming back to is how recently America, particularly in a place like Alabama, has been a non-racial democracy.
Right.
200 years a slave state, 100 years an apartheid state. It's only relatively recently, in the last 50 years, that America has been a non-racial democracy, and particularly in Alabama, arguably even more recently than that. Alabama only formally legalized within the state interracial marriage 15, 20 years ago. And so while these divides are shocking when one understands America as only a Western country, when one understands it as a particular kind of Western country, then I think that informs what we're talking about. But what is disturbing in another sense is the degree to which those divisions are now being replicated throughout the country, that in a way, America looks to me like it is becoming more southern than the South is becoming more like the rest of America.
Gary, did you ever visit Alabama when you were U.S. correspondent for The Guardian?
Many times, many, many times.
So yes. What do you tell your friends about this part of the U.S.? I mean, Doug Jones, he prosecuted the 16th Street Baptist Church bombings from 1963. Do Brits wonder how it's possible he had to fight for this victory?
I tell them, and, you know, I'm being honest here, that some of the most fantastic times I've had in America have been in the South. That it's there that I've met some of the most wonderful people, both black and white. It's my favorite part of the country, actually, the American South. because it's a part of the country that where everybody has known pain. Black people have known pain, you know, segregation and so on. White people have known pain through losing the Civil War and being a poorer part of America, even though they're generally the richer part of it. And pain makes people more interesting. But that it's also the least familiar in terms of religiosity in particular, but also in terms of racial mores, if you're coming from elsewhere in the West.
This is the perfect place to talk about your travels through America, including in parts of the South, for your new documentary, Angry White and American. This encounter happened with the white supremacist Richard Spencer. Let's just hear this.
Look at the average life of an African-American in the United States. It's far better than any African living in Africa.
Really? So slavery was good for them?
They benefited from being in a different nation than their own, no doubt.
Really?
No doubt. How can you deny that?
Sorry?
How can you deny such
it's
an obvious
such
fact?
A ridiculous notion.
How is it ridiculous?
It's such a ridiculous,
notion
that people
wow, extraordinary. Gary, I think about the point and a half victory of Doug Jones over Roy Moore in Alabama. Is your conversation with Spencer a bit like the conversation one part of America is trying to have with itself?
I arrived in 2003, which was just before the Iraq War, and left in 2015. And during that time, I saw the country become more and more divided. Divided on racial lines, yes, but actually on deeply philosophical lines about what America was for, what its place in the world should be, what its government should do, and divided in a way, and this, you know, is now familiar in Britain, you know, we've seen it through Brexit, working from different information sources, so people who know different things and therefore feel the capacity to believe different things. And each time you didn't think it could get worse, something else would come along which would kind of aggravate it. And, you know, that's where I think we are now. That my guess is that a large number of white Alabamians looked at these accusations of sexual impropriety where Roy Moore was concerned and thought, there are those liberal Yankees ridiculing us again, making things up, trying to undermine our way of life, and we're not going to have it. And that sense of siege, which I think a significant section of white America has, this sense that they are besieged, brooks no contrary argument. So none of the arguments are going through, to the point where you're only talking about a country in the sense that people share a flag and an anthem, but the sense of what it means to be a member of that country, the trajectory of the country, the history of the country, if we look at the monument arguments and so on, has kind of almost completely fallen apart. Racially in particular, it seems the most polarized to me since the civil rights era.
Gary Young of The Guardian speaking with us from London. It's so great to have your voice on this particular Wednesday. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
In San Francisco, they're mourning their mayor. Ed Lee died early yesterday after reportedly collapsing while shopping at a supermarket. There are many ways to remember Lee. Recently, he'd been outspoken in standing up to President Trump on immigration, promoting San Francisco as a sanctuary city for undocumented immigrants. But today, we want to remember one of the last things Ed Lee was known for as mayor, his support for a statue honoring comfort women. In other words, women and girls from China, Korea, the Philippines, and other countries who were forced to work as sex slaves by occupying Japanese troops during World War II. Retired Judge Lillian Singh also worked to get that statue up in San Francisco. She was a friend of the late mayor. You co-chair the Comfort Women Justice Coalition in San Francisco. How did you become involved with that group? How did you get connected to this story?
I have been fighting for justice all my life. I served as the first Asian American female judge in Northern California, and I dispensed justice every day of my life in court. When I read the book, The Rape of Nanjing, by Iris Chan, I was deeply moved, and I wonder why the world has not known about that horrific Nanjing massacre, and where is justice for these victims? And I decided that I will retire from my position as a judge and help build a Comfort Women Memorial in San Francisco.
Yeah, so this was a really important mission for you. Can you describe the statue?
Oh, the statue is beautiful. It's three girls, a Chinese girl, a Korean girl, and a Filipino girl, holding hand in hand, standing proudly in defiance of Japan. And in front of the three girls is an older woman by the name of Hak Soon Kim. She's the first Korean woman that broke her silence in 1991 and told the world about what happened.
So Chinese, Korean, and Filipino girls depicted in the statue, it turned out to be really controversial. Why is that?
Well, because the inscription says that this monument bears witness to the suffering of hundreds of thousands of women and girls euphemistically called comfort women, who were sexually enslaved by the Japanese Imperial Armed Forces in 13 Asian Pacific countries from 1931 to 1945. And Japan doesn't like that.
So what's been the reaction from Japan, specifically from Osaka, which is a twin city with San Francisco?
It's a sister city with San Francisco. The relationship goes back to 60 years. Osaka mayor wrote our mayor, Ed Lee, a letter saying that if you don't tear this memorial down, we're going to break off our ties. That is called a threat. That is bullying us in San Francisco. Mayor Lee did not succumb to that threat, signed a resolution, and we hail him as a hero.
So it was really a big deal for Ed Lee to champion this monument. What convinced him to do it now?
Well, I think Mayor Lee stood up to not only Japan, but to President Trump and other racist anti-immigration bullies. Mayor Lee was a long and strong supporter of the comfort women and other victims who were suppressed and didn't have a voice to represent themselves.
Judge Singh, I don't want to overemphasize ethnicity in this story, but I am curious. You were Northern California's, as you said, Northern California's first Asian American woman judge, and Mayor Lee was the first Asian American mayor of San Francisco. Did the two of you ever talk about your backgrounds or about what it meant to be a first?
You know, we did talk about the demands, the challenges of being the first. But once you do that, you move on. You move on to do the best you can, and you forget you are the first. But what happened is that once you become the first, there'll be second, third, fourth, and fifth. There's a Chinese saying, if I may quote that, 过桥不要臭板. When you cross the bridge, don't pull the planks behind you. Help those behind you to succeed. And I think Mayor Lee was doing that, and I tried to do that all my life as well. Today, a poor Chinese American boy or girl can inspire to be the mayor of San Francisco. When I was first growing up in San Francisco, Chinese could not even cross the street around Broadway because you're only limited to Chinatown. You can't go into City Hall. No. City Hall was a forbidden place for non-whites. You just had no voice, no power, no representation. After Mayor Lee, things have changed. We have more Chinese Americans in public office. And today, we have more Chinese Americans as judges.
Don't pull up the plank behind you. I like that. Retired Judge Lillian Singh on her friend, the late mayor of San Francisco, Ed Lee, and his support for a statue for comfort women. Judge Singh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the show, another story about people caught up in war. This one, though, is a love story. It begins in 1950.
It is tragic indeed that war should strike the South Korean people.
He was a U.S. soldier. She was a young Korean who worked for the Americans.
And years later, I asked her, how come you would never go on a date with me when I asked you? Later on, she said, oh, yes, I always liked you too, but my mother didn't like anybody going out with me.
Their love story spans seven decades, from Seoul to Washington, D.C., and a journey back to Korea. That's tomorrow, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. With so many eyes on election results from Alabama, you might have missed this.
Biz bugün Kudüs'ü Filistin'in başkenti olarak tanıdığımızı ilan ettik.
That's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, saying, today we officially recognize Jerusalem as the Palestinian capital city. He also called Israel a terror state. Erdogan was speaking in Istanbul at an emergency meeting of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. 50 Muslim leaders from around the world were there. The gathering was actually a response to President Trump's announcement last week recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That's something that even a staunch U.S. ally like King Abdullah of Jordan doesn't endorse.
My dear friends, Jerusalem is most holy in Islam. It is in the hearts of all Muslims, as it is in the hearts of all Christians. Our right, Muslims and Christians, to Jerusalem is eternal.
King Abdullah rejected any attempt to change the status quo of Jerusalem, and he said the Middle East would never reach peace until the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was resolved. The Trump administration says for its part, it'll continue to work for peace in the Middle East, and that the president's declaration on Jerusalem leaves the door open for talks on the city's future borders and status. But it's clear many leaders and people in the region no longer trust the U.S. as an unbiased negotiating partner. Here's the U.S.-backed president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas.
We shall not accept any role for the United States in the peace process. They have proven their full bias in favor of Israel.
Abbas also called Trump's Jerusalem declaration a crime. After Muslim leaders in Istanbul made their statements on the status of Jerusalem, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu responded. He called on other countries to follow Trump's lead and recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. If Jerusalem is one flashpoint in the Middle East, the Israeli-Lebanese border is another, and one group that's been emboldened there is the Lebanese Shiite militia Hezbollah. It's been a major player in the war in Syria. President Trump has called Hezbollah a menace and a threat to Israel, and there are fears that Israel and Hezbollah might be headed for another war. But there's a buffer between them, a force of 10,000 UN peacekeepers from all over the world. The world's Richard Hall went on patrol with a few of them to get a feel for the current mood at the border.
What are you looking for on these patrols specifically?
Any violation, but it's specifically in this patrol, we're looking for rocket launching systems.
I'm squashed into the back of an armored personnel carrier with peacekeepers from the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, or UNIFIL for short. We are in Hezbollah country, looking for any sign of the thousands of rockets that the militant group says it has pointed at Israel.
We're heading to the first observation point, see if we can watch something, strange movements.
That's Lieutenant Alejandro Collado Corzo, a UN peacekeeper from Spain. His job is made all the more difficult by there being no official border between Lebanon and Israel, only a so-called blue line. That's the point to which the Israeli army withdrew to when it left most of Lebanon in 2000. The strange movements Lieutenant Corzo is looking out for on this patrol could be anything from a fighter moving weapons to a shepherd getting lost. That happens more often than you might think.
Sometimes it's difficult to know if you're trespassing the blue line. So sometimes we have problems with shepherds and herds because they cross the blue line. And Israel call us to ask them to move out.
The infractions are not always so trivial. In 2006, a cross-border raid by Hezbollah sparked a devastating war. The group was founded in the 80s to kick Israel out of Lebanon. And Hezbollah and Israel have fought a series of bitter battles that were never really resolved. Today, Israeli jets violate Lebanese airspace on a daily basis, and Israel still occupies Lebanese land. Deadly clashes have erupted on the blue line over things as minor as an errant tree branch. And yet, UN spokesman Andrea Tenenti tells me the UN's presence has helped bring stability to southern Lebanon.
The last 11 years in south of Lebanon has witnessed one of the quietest periods in its recent history.
That may be, but the war in Syria next door has made Hezbollah much stronger. It boasts of having thousands more rockets than it did in the last conflict with Israel, which both sides claim to have won. Israel fears that Iran will arm Hezbollah with more effective guided missiles. And there's been speculation that Israel might launch military action to remove the threat of Hezbollah's weapons once and for all. A few miles from the border, in the town of Marj Ayun, I meet Eli Madi in his hardware store. He's a really interesting guy. He grew up here, moved to Beirut for work, went to university in the UK before moving back again. I wanted to get a sense of how locals felt about the UN, Hezbollah, and the whole mess down here.
Forget Hezbollah. We are a country that was raised like me. I was raised that Israel is our enemy. Okay? So, it's not about Hezbollah. It's about Israel. We're not supporting Hezbollah. We're supporting the resistance.
That's a common view down here in the south. Hezbollah has widespread support among its Shiite base, but even those who don't support the group see it as a deterrent to Israeli attack, as a form of resistance. The memory of the 2006 war, which destroyed much of South Lebanon, is fresh in people's minds. More than 1,200 civilians were killed.
The Lebanese army cannot stand in front of Israel, let's face it, okay? But the resistance can, because they don't play it by the book. If we go on war with Israel, with the army, I think they will kick our ass big times. The resistance, no. They will hurt us. We will bleed, but we will not die.
We drive a little way down the road to the town of Kfar Kela, right on the border. We stop on top of a hill with a sweeping view over Israeli villages. I was surprised at how close they were. You can almost see into the windows of the houses. A large metal fence runs in front of us about 30 feet away, alongside a patrol road for Israeli army vehicles. A few UN soldiers stand around. Judah LaCruz, a resident of a nearby town, has come to take pictures of Israel with her two friends. She's a big fan of the UNIFIL troops.
Without UNIFIL, we cannot live. They are helping in making peace here.
I asked her whether another war could break out down here. She doesn't think so. She says things are different now. The last war in 2006 took everyone by surprise. But both sides are aware now of how even small skirmishes can spiral out of control. Besides, she adds, Lebanon is more likely to go to war with itself before taking on another war with its neighbor. For the World, Richard Hall on the Lebanon-Israel border.
I'm Marco Werman. As president, he pushed Estonia to digitize its government bureaucracy. Then he moved to Silicon Valley.
The biggest shock of being in the mecca of innovation in IT is the bureaucracy is stuck at a level that has really not substantially changed since the 1950s.
Talking IT with Tomas Hendrik Ilves, that's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So here's a fantasy, a world where you never have to wait in line at the DMV. You could do everything motor vehicle online, except for the driving test, of course. But you could change your address or submit proof of residence online. Other things in life could work just as efficiently, like voting or going to the doctor. Any doctor you'd visit would already have access to your digitally stored medical data, and you'd never have to fill out one of those medical history forms in the waiting room again. In Estonia, these things and more are already reality. Tiny Estonia, parked up there in the Baltics, it's got a population less than half of Silicon Valley's, but it's managed to put itself on the map as one of the most innovative places in the world by digitizing almost all aspects of citizen life. The initiative is called the Estonia Project, and the government has also taken steps to secure all of that data. Estonia's former president, Tomas Hendrik Ilves, has been a driving force behind the effort, and this week he's being recognized for some of his work in the cyber arena at Harvard, right in our backyard. Ilves joined us from the Harvard campus across the river in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I began by asking him what it means to live in a virtual society.
It's nothing too sophisticated. It simply means that you can do digitally what you otherwise do on paper, and it's more transparent, more open, faster and efficient. It's really not that odd at all. It's just you think about instead of signing papers and having them move from one place to another, you sign something digitally. You have a legal signature that works in digital space, and you can do it from home rather than having to go and stand in line in different offices.
Well, let me give you my example, President Ilves. You're in my city of Cambridge, Massachusetts today, and I just had an annoying interaction with Cambridge City Hall to renew my annual parking sticker. They sent my application back to me because the utility bill I sent them to prove I live at the residence I've lived at for the last 12 years did not have my name on it. Can you walk us through how this process would have gone in Estonia?
Well, I mean, the utility bill's sole utility, as it were, is to say you live where you are. Whereas in Estonia, I mean, that's part of your digital identity, which says that you live here. So in your case, basically, you would be on record as living where you are until you change your address, and then for your own convenience, you would want to say that you have changed your place of residence. I mean, you don't have to do that, but if you do, then you have that proof.
Yeah, sounds nice and sensical. Is your goal to bring the system to other EU states?
Well, yes, it is. I mean, it would be this entire system becomes much more powerful when it works cross-border. But that takes a long time. 5 years ago, I proposed to the president of Finland that our digital prescriptions would work across borders. And it's going to go into effect next year. So that's 6 years, basically. The technology side of this would take a couple of days, I'd say. But getting it done politically takes a long time. I mean, legally and the regulatory side of things. Now, it's actually a fairly unique accomplishment. This does not exist anywhere else in the world. So to get from there to all of the EU is going to take a while.
Now, it may appear that the government slowly disappears when this transition to a virtual government is complete. But can you set us straight? I mean, surely the real Estonian government can't just disappear. What happens to it, though, and its authority?
Well, I mean, it's really administration we're talking about. In the European sense, the government is the elected cabinet, and the administrative side is what becomes increasingly transparent, but also it decreases in size. It's kind of the bureaucratic version of the state withering away, as Karl Marx once envisioned it. But, I mean, think of most of the things that you deal with in your personal interaction with the government, as your case of proving where you live. I mean, there's simple decisions that don't require human intervention. In my own country, after you do your driver's test, you don't go to the DMV. Even if you have to update your, you know, do an eye test, you go to a eye doctor, but the eye doctor sends in the information that now you need glasses or something.
Wow.
I mean, there's no need for all of that brick and mortar and flesh and bone bureaucracy when the decisions are things that are made more efficiently and more, I mean, honestly, by algorithms.
Wow, imagine never having to go to the DMV again. With so much reliance on algorithms and data in a system like this, I mean, there are a lot of privacy and security questions that come to mind. Let's just start with privacy, because many of our listeners might hear about Estonia and think Big Brother. What does privacy look like under a system like this?
Well, first of all, we clearly prescribe who can look at what. And every interaction is logged. If anyone looks at something, you know who's looked at it. If someone looks at it who shouldn't be looking at it, it immediately sets off an alarm. And why I find the question a little odd, I keep getting it every day, I just had it about half an hour ago, is that compared to what? I mean, if all the same data are in paper form, there's no record of who's gone in there and looked at your data, right?
President Ilves, I mean, you've said in the past that our obsession with privacy is misguided. Can you explain that?
Well, I meant that as opposed to the security of the data itself. It's not the issue of the concern for privacy, but rather that a far more important aspect is data integrity. It may bother me if someone publishes the contents of my bank account or my blood type records. Data integrity is someone changes my bank account or someone changes the record of my blood type. I mean, the last one could be fatal. And so this sort of, when I say people are obsessed with privacy, is that they're not worried at all by far worse things than loss of privacy, which is the loss of data integrity.
So how is Estonia keeping all of this data safe?
Well, our data are on blockchain, so that means that you can't change the data, or any change can only be made by the authorized individuals. That's you on your own data, or your doctor who you've authorized, or some, you know, similar authority. And that takes care of that issue of someone changing your health record, changing your property record, indeed changing court records. since those are all digital too.
Mm.
Well, one other thing that we've done, I mean, which is more peculiar to our size and our location, I mean, having been invaded about 20 times in the last 1,000 years, we also have a data embassy abroad in Luxembourg where we have store copies updated constantly of all national data.
So you're a visiting fellow at Stanford, as I said. Can you just give us your assessment of American bureaucracy? Where does it sit on the evolutionary timeline?
Well,
be honest.
Well, I would just say that the biggest shock of being in the mecca of innovation in IT is the bureaucracy is stuck at a level that has really not substantially changed since the 1950s.
Yeah, and you're in Silicon Valley.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, I think that it's at the same level as elsewhere in the United States. It's just the contrast is especially strong where within 10 miles of me are the headquarters of Facebook, Google, Apple, Tesla. You just keep naming them. Yet, and you can do all kinds of things, you know, play with augmented reality, but if you have to prove that you live where you live to get your child to be registered for school, you have to come in with a paper copy of your electricity bill. The reality of your sort of life dealing with bureaucracy, it is not touched by the digital revolution.
That was Tomas Hendrik Ilves. He's the former president of Estonia and now a distinguished fellow at Stanford University. Now to a story that highlights the darker side of that intersection between government and technology. My colleague at the BBC, John Sudworth, recently reported on how closed-circuit TV cameras in one city in China can now monitor everyone, every single person in the city, using artificial intelligence. His report is titled, In Your Face, China's All-Seeing State. And honestly, if this is what the future could look like everywhere in the world eventually, it is pretty darn scary.
I mean, obviously, facial recognition cameras are out there in the world, used in a lot of applications in many countries, but few are using them in the way that China is, as part of routine policing across a whole city. Guiyang City wouldn't tell us precisely how many cameras they had equipped with this kind of technology, but they said it numbered in the thousands. Of course, the real point of the technology is that they have loaded into their database the photo of every one of Guiyang's 4 million residents. The database contains in a sort of digital algorithm. People's faces are mapped, turned into a unique code based on measurements between key points in their face, distance between your pupils, distance from nose to top lip. Everybody's measurements will be unique. And if somebody is flagged as a suspect, they are automatically picked up. And it's only a matter of time, of course, before real police officers can be dispatched to pick them up.
So you visited one of the factories in China where these cameras with the artificial intelligence are made. The company's called Dahua Tech, and you sat down with a rep named Yin Jun. Let's hear what he had to say.
What he's telling us, Marco, is that the cameras can not only match your face with the image in the database, but once that match is made, the system can then trace your steps back through the city of Guiyang over a complete week in time. He also mentions that these cameras can not only track you in real time, but they can, of course, also find out who you're associating with. And they can match you with your regular associates, with friends and families, and build up a picture of not only where you've been, but who you've been there with.
So, John, you got access to the big secret room where the authorities can track any person in Guiyang. What did it look like, and what were people actually doing?
So in many ways, it looks like your standard police control room, people sitting at desks, obviously, with all the communications. They can talk to officers on the street from this control room. But up in the front of this room is this extraordinary screen stretching the length and height of one whole side of that control room. And by using that screen, they are pretty much able to watch the whole city, a city of 4 million people. When you think that system is then enhanced by this artificial intelligence capability as a policing tool, it's probably on a par with nowhere else in the world.
So you got the officials in Guiyang to kind of play along with the conceit that you were a suspect and they had to track you down. Tell us how that went.
So they took my photograph. stuck it into the database and then flagged me as a suspect. Well, let's see how long it takes you to find me. Thank you very much. Let's go. I then left the police control room, headed down to the city centre.
Well, here we are then. I've just got out of the car, close to the city centre, and for the purposes of this exercise, the plan is for me to start walking in the direction of the bus station. My image has already been flagged to the authorities as a suspect, and in theory, it should only be a matter of time.
Now, I could see, as in any Chinese city, cameras pretty much everywhere I looked.
So already on this bridge, I can see one, two, three CCTV cameras. Of course, there's no point hiding from them. Just keep on walking.
What I wasn't able to tell is which one of those had the facial recognition technology, but I moved around the city, heading in the direction of the bus station, trying to act and look like a Western tourist. As I approached the bus station, very quickly, one of these cameras was clearly activated.
Uh-oh. Right behind me, you can see, just over my left shoulder there.
And within a matter of a couple of minutes or so after that, a group of police officers moved in.
Hello, guys.
From start to finish, from the moment I stepped out of the car in the centre of the city to me being arrested, the whole thing took just 7 minutes.
Wow, 7 minutes. Did you ever worry that someone in the system might not know or understand that your being a suspect was a conceit?
Well, actually, when the guys picked me up in the bus station...
Hello, guys.
My initial reaction was, well done, guys, you know.
I've been expecting you.
You know, offered to shake their hand. But they didn't look like they were having any of it.
Oh, maybe these guys aren't in on the joke.
And I couldn't tell to begin with whether they really felt they had caught me as a suspect or whether this for them was just something that was being run as a drill. I think actually it transpired in the end that that's exactly what it was. They'd been told to treat this as a real scenario. So they were being pretty serious about it all when they first apprehended me. I think it's a clear demonstration that this stuff works, that it works with some accuracy, and this is in use in Beijing, in Shanghai, in Shenzhen, many of the big cities, and in fact, many of them are all, you know, at Guoyang's own admission, many of the bigger cities are already at a stage more advanced than the system that we saw. The tech company we spoke to made it very clear that their vision is that this won't just be in the big cities, but this will be nationwide. And obviously the power of that system in the hands of a government which may not face too many checks and balances on how it works against opponents and critics, for example, for many, well, that would seem like a pretty scary prospect.
My colleague at the BBC, John Sudworth, thanks very much for telling us about all this.
Thank you, Marco.
It's been almost 4 months, and residents of the Houston area are still recovering from Hurricane Harvey. The massive storm dumped more than 4 feet of rain on some parts of Texas back in August. At the time, lots of people, including us here at The World, were asking how much climate change played a role in the storm's intensity. Well, now we have some idea. Two new scientific analyses released today show that warmer temperatures linked to climate change did probably make the storm worse than it would have been otherwise. Our Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler is here to explain these two scientific studies in plain English. What did these two reports find, Carolyn?
They basically found that climate change led to a lot more rain falling than might have otherwise been the case. 15% to 38% more rainfall, depending on which of these studies you're looking at.
Right.
And one of the studies by the World Weather Attribution Network found that climate change made a storm like Harvey 3 times more likely than it would have been in a world without climate change.
And tell us exactly why that would be. Like, what is the link between warmer temperatures and climate change?
So warmer temperatures mean more water evaporates into the air. It also means the air can hold more water, which means that air can then dump more water onto the ground in these big precipitation events. But that only accounts for part of the increase, according to the lead author of the Weather Attribution Network study. His name is Hert-Jan van Oldenburg.
We expected at least the 6-7% that you get from an increase in moisture in the atmosphere. We were surprised to find more than that in the observations and one of the two climate models.
So this study didn't look at what the rest of that rainfall increase was caused by, but one theory is that climate change is making winds moving from the Gulf inland stronger, which means they can, you know, bring more precipitation from the Gulf.
Now, this science of figuring out exactly how much of a weather event is caused by climate change, this is pretty new. How did these two teams do these studies?
So they used somewhat similar models. So we'll focus here on von Oldenburg's group. So they took historic rainfall data from across the Gulf of Mexico going back to the 1800s, and they figured out the probability in the real world of an event like this happening. And then they compared that using computer models to the probability of an event like this happening in a world where there was no climate change and compared those two figures.
It sounds like researchers were surprised by just how much climate change fueled the rains of Harvey. What struck you, Carolyn, about these studies?
Not so much what these studies told us about Harvey, but what they tell us about the future. Now, there's a lot of uncertainty here, but von Oldenburg's study found that if we continue burning fossil fuels like we do today, the intensity of storms like Harvey could increase by up to 50%.
Wow.
And it could be 10 times more likely. Now, it's still pretty unlikely, but when you look at the costs of Harvey, it's been linked to the deaths of more than 80 people, flooded something like 100,000 homes. I think it's important to remember that these storms going forward are going to be just slightly more common than they are today.
The World's Livable Planet reporter Carolyn Beeler unpacking today's news on the link between climate change and Hurricane Harvey. Carolyn, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
One of the big causes of climate change is, no surprise here, smoke from burning coal. Countries around the world say they're committed to switching from coal to cleaner sources of electricity like wind and solar power. But it is a difficult transition, not least because wind and solar aren't always there when you need them. But what if you could essentially store surplus wind and solar energy in something like a big hole in the ground? And what if that big hole were, say, an abandoned coal mine? Ironic? Yeah. Far-fetched? Maybe not. Also from our Livable Planet desk, here's reporter Valerie Hamilton.
Standing at the top of a shaft at the Prosper Haniel coal mine, what most people see is just a tunnel going into a big black hole. But Andre Niemann looked into that black hole and saw the future.
Prosper Haniel, the site of Prosper Haniel, it's really special because it's the last mine in this region. And everybody's looking, okay, what's happening now?
Niemann leads the Hydraulic Engineering and Water Resources Department at the University of Duisburg-Essen, just a few miles from here. He is a scientist, but he also grew up in coal country. Six of his mother's 12 siblings worked in the mines. So for him, the end of underground coal mining here is of more than academic interest.
I like this idea of a post-mining landscape with aspects of sustainable development, giving something back to the nature, giving back something back to the people. Let's keep the tradition still alive.
Germany's underground coal mines can't compete with cheaper imports, so the country is phasing them out. At the same time, it's also working to slash its CO2 emissions by replacing fossil fuels like coal with renewable energy sources like wind and solar. But there's a big problem with wind and solar. They're not always there when you need them. So there's a big push to find ways to store electricity from the sun and wind when there's more than you need, to save for times when there's less than you need. That's where Niemann's vision for the soon-to-be-closed Prosper Haniel mine comes in.
The more deep this facility is located, the more energy could be produced.
The idea is to turn this deep old coal mine into a new pumped energy storage facility, basically a gigantic water-powered battery.
Okay, good. Okay.
There's a model of the project in a two-story lab on the university's campus in Essen. Research assistant Jonas Nienhaus turns it on for me.
And I will raise it to the maximum.
Okay.
So it will be really loud.
Here's how it works. Deep at the bottom of the mine, a huge amount of water will be stored in 9 miles of pipes. When the sun and wind are producing more electricity than the grid needs, some of that excess power will be used to pump the water up to a reservoir on the surface. In this model, the reservoir is a tank upstairs in the lab. When the grid needs more power, the water is released to fall back down, turning turbines and generating electricity on its way, like in a hydroelectric dam. In the real mine, the water would fall close to 2,000 feet, producing enough power for almost 500,000 homes. So far, the system can regenerate 85% of the energy used to pump the water up in the first place. It's not bad, considering the original energy would otherwise be wasted. And its benefits in storing renewable energy would be only part of its appeal. Niemann says it would also be a powerful symbol.
It shows responsibility. It shows that if mining is over, you're not leaving the place. If this is a nice story, that you will make something out of it.
If it's a story, it's a cliffhanger. So far, no company has actually signed on to invest the roughly $700 million it would take to make the project happen. But Germany has recycled coal mines before. In the city of Bochum, warm water circulating through an old mine heats two schools and a fire station. Another German mine near here is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, hosting restaurants, galleries, and a coal mining museum. Niemann is hoping the government will step in before the Prosperhaniel mine shuts down next year and the window of opportunity closes.
So it's a 50-50. So it will be realized, I'm quite sure. But I'm not really sure about Prosperhaniel.
But he is sure that some coal mine somewhere will become a pumped storage system. He's been talking to engineers and officials in coal regions from Australia to Poland to the United States. He says they all want to know the same thing, if there's a greener second act for their coal mines, too. For The World, Valerie Hamilton, Essen, Germany.
You can hear all of Valerie's stories on the end of underground coal mining in Germany at PRI.org. That's all time we got for today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you all for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.